Welcome to the latest episode of the Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. My guest today is Mark Guntrip, Senior Director of Cybersecurity Strategy at Menlo Security. Mark, hello.
Great to be here.
Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
I accidentally fell into the cybersecurity world, as I think many people of my age did when I came out of school. The project that I was working on was a firewall, and I haven't looked back since. I've been around 20-ish years across networking, content security, from some of the big companies like the Ciscos and Symantecs of the world, down to some startups. After 6.5 years at Proofpoint, I moved over to Menlo Security to try and get back to what is it that makes a security company great from a technology perspective, from an end-user perspective, to grow that and try and make a difference in the world about how we can make it a lot more difficult for the attackers and a lot easier for the security teams out there to stop those threats coming in.
We're going to be talking about heat attacks in a minute, but I've got to ask the question, how do you strategize cybersecurity from a vendor perspective?
As you look at strategy, it's about what the problem is, how do you solve it, what's the best way to do it, and then how do you prove that? You can have a strategy, but if nobody believes the strategy, then the strategy is useless. A lot of what we do is in terms of how can we prove the problem exists, how can we prove that somebody might suffer from that problem, and then how can we prove that our solution will actually be able to solve that problem for you. So for me, it's really a few things, but ultimately it comes down to what do we sell, who do we sell it to, what problem do we solve, and how do we prove value.
So many questions I could come back on there, but I won't because we don't have time here today. So we're going to be talking about heat attacks. What is a heat attack?
Heat, because everyone in the security industry was always one acronym short of a full set. So we're delivering that for them. Everyone's got their bingo card done now. Heat stands for highly evasive adaptive threats. That's a mouthful, which is why we put it down to heat. We look at the kill chain of how does somebody get to, and I'll use ransomware as the example, just because it's top of mind for many, but it really could be anything at the end. It could be a Trojan or whatever it might be. But we look at the problem of ransomware. Everyone cares about ransomware. It will stop my business. It will cost me a lot of money. There's a lot of pain involved with ransomware. But that's at the very, very end of the chain. As we look at heat attacks, to get to a ransomware attack, first of all, you're going to be on the network or on a device on whatever you're doing, collecting data, credentials, whatever it might be, taking whatever you want. But to be able to get there, you had to have that initial incursion. What did I get on your network or on your device to enable me to do everything else? As we look at heat, what we're doing is looking at that initial malware incursion. How did they get in? What did they do? What do organizations en masse have at their disposal in terms of security capabilities, and how do those threats evade the controls that are in there?
That highly evasive adaptive, we've had polymorphic attacks for a decade, 15 years now. Surely they're highly evasive and adaptive. So what makes this new generation of attacks different to what we've become used to dealing with?
There's elements of heat attacks that have existed forever. There's ways to get around antivirus. Pretty easy. What did we do as an industry? We added another layer, like reputation. How do I get past reputation? Well, there's ways we can do that. Okay, then I'll put in my IPS. I'll put in my sandbox. We've added all those extra barriers in there. Some of them are old and have been around for some time. Some of the techniques that are out there are new. Some of the things, maybe we'll talk in a little bit about HTML smuggling and how attackers are actually getting past any of the content analysis that's out there just by using legitimate software practices in a malicious way. But as we also look at the landscape, I think the landscape has helped massively. I'll dive straight in on the reputation piece. If you can turn a good site bad or use a good site to deliver malware, then it's probably going to get through reputation. As we look at Log4j and the vulnerabilities that are out there, do you know what just opened up? Millions of websites that attackers can very easily go and inject what they want and use that legitimate website for their own purposes. So is it new? Some of it is. Is it growing? Absolutely. And we're looking at really the combination of the two of these things. So it's not necessarily we have four different techniques, but we're seeing things that might use a legitimate site that's going to turn bad, and I'm going to use that to deliver HTML smuggling campaigns. We're really seeing the cross-pollination of these different techniques, but it all ultimately comes down to what's in the security stack. That fundamentally hasn't changed in the last 10 to 12 years. The sandbox was probably the last wall. the last barrier that en masse many organizations adopted to say, I am going to stop threats before they come into my organization. And that's given the attackers, the cyber gangs, the nation states a decade to figure out, how do I get past that? And some of it is super simple, because do you know what every sandbox has? It has a file size limit. And if you send a file that is just above that, it doesn't even analyze it. Then the business had to make a decision. Do I allow all big files or do I block all big files? And I can tell you which one they're going to choose. They're going to choose to allow them because I don't want to get in the way of business. So if you send that, whatever the limit might be, you choose organization by organization. But if your limit's 100 meg and I send you a 102 meg file with malware in it, you're not going to check it. It's just going to go straight through. So it can be really simple, but we're seeing a lot more elegant ways out there of getting past these defenses as well.
We'll come back to some of those defenses in a minute. You mentioned there that it's a growing attack. Now, one of the problems we have as an industry is we're very quick to find a new attack and talk it up. The only way to really understand is to get some idea of how much it's growing by. And I'm only going to ask you what you see from your customers, because to ask you to make some crystal ball assessment across the entire industry would be just ridiculous. So when you look at your customer base, how many of the attacks that they're dealing with fall into your categorization of a heat attack?
I'll give you two answers to that, because I have one that's a little bit broader than our customer base. We analyzed just over 500 million malicious URLs. We knew that they were delivering malware, and we wanted to figure out how. What did you do? From the first half of 2021 to the second half, so just 6 months, we saw that number of attacks rise 224%. A very big increase in a very short amount of time from a fixed known bad data set. So not saying everything, but from that data set that we analyzed.
But what was that base number they started with? Because a rise of 224%, if it was only 2% to begin with, is still statistically a very small amount. If that base amount was 30% of the attacks you were seeing, that's now a pandemic. So where on that scale did you start?
Of the attacks, which we saw towards the back end of last year, just under 70% were classified as using heat categories, heat techniques to get through. They're using a very constrained number of things that work very well to get to the goal that they wanted to get to. Coming back to the fact that, is all of this new? No. Some of it's been around for a very long time, some of it very new. But it's gaining steam. Let's be honest, it's very rare a threat graph goes down and to the right. It keeps on going up. But we're certainly seeing the use of these heat attacks, these heat tactics to gain that initial incursion, getting up to the majority of the attacks that are coming in.
Do you see it as being perhaps a temporary spike, or is this ramping itself up in such a way that you believe it's going to have much more depth and continuation to it?
I think the very non-committal answer to that is it depends. What I mean by that is the whole premise of a heat attack is, how do I get past the technology that you have in place? If we stand still and we all use the same techniques and technologies and everything else, is it going to get worse? Yes, because it works. I know how to do it. As an attack group, I'll just do it again and do it again and do more of it to everybody. If we look at the solution in a different way and say, well, maybe we need to do something different, maybe we need to put another barrier in front of them to at least stop that flow of threats coming in, then maybe it'll go down. Maybe we will see that threat graph go down and to the right. But as an industry, we need to make that decision that actually what we're doing today isn't enough. And depending who you listen to, the numbers will change. But as you look at security spending on the rise, we're spending more on security, but we're actually spending even more on mopping up threats that got past the security that we spent more money on. So we're spending more to stop them and more because it just didn't work. We need to do something different to try and get the results that we want.
But a lot of that spend on security is adding tools into the environment. And adding those tools into the environment isn't necessarily making it harder for the attacker. It's making it harder for the defenders, because they've got to integrate those tools if they can. Or they've got to go into multiple administration areas. That leaves us with cracks that are easily exploited. When you look across the market at the moment, of that increase in spending, how much of that is productive spend? And how much of that is a reaction to a Gartner survey or something else that's come out?
I will give you my perspective on this. As an industry, you look in the media, you look at the technology trend, whichever letter you choose to put first, but DR, whether it's EDR, NDR, XDR, has kind of taken center stage. When I'm looking to try and constrain attacks once they get in, how can I respond to that? Which isn't stopping the problem. So if you look at the data that we're looking at that initial incursion and how did it get in. The spend, the technology du jour of XDR is, well, it's in. How can I detect it and respond in a timely manner and mop it up and try and stop it before it makes too much? So it's really solving further down in the chain than the attacks coming in. Is it helping? Yes. Is it doing the best that we could? I think it's helping. It's not preventing anything from happening in the first place. But to your point about integration, because I think that's very valid, obviously there's very many ways to integrate something, whether it's just logs and visibility on the back end of what happened. Something happened, let me figure out who did what and where and everything else. Looking at security capabilities that are tightly integrated, not necessarily all from one vendor, but tightly integrated from a policy perspective, as well as from a visibility perspective, is key. You can't have, and I'll just pick a few in here, you can't have your endpoint policy be different at all in reality to anything you want to stop coming into your network. You can't allow something on my endpoint, I don't let it in my network. That makes no sense. Everything has to align. And so choosing solutions that, whether it's API-based, maybe it is from a single vendor, that actually you can build policy once and use it multiple times, I think is going to get us to where we need to be, which is consistent, and hopefully not having as many cracks that an attacker could utilize to try and sneak through the defenses that you've got.
How do we actually address the real problem that we have? If I take ransomware as an example, the problem with ransomware is the end of a chain of other things. The industry has gone out there and it's released all these anti-ransomware solutions. But actually, many of those same vendors have been selling all the early parts of the defense mechanism, which kind of suggests that all those early parts are either redundant or ineffective, or they're being sold something they don't necessarily need. They just need to use the other bits better. When you talk about the adaptive and evasive mechanisms here, how many of those could be addressed by better use of what companies have rather than new tooling? And if we do need new tooling, how do we bring that in and make it effective?
Okay, there's two questions there. The first one around the tooling piece. The issue that we have just as an entire architecture of where security sits is something that the attackers are taking advantage of already. Because if you think of network security, you see the bits and bytes, the packets and everything as they're flowing through, and you've got to make a determination. Is it good? Is it bad? Yes? No? What do I do? But the problem is that, and I'll use HTML smuggling, which I mentioned earlier, what you see on the network isn't necessarily what you see at the endpoint on the device. And I'm using the browser as a very obvious example here. With COVID, with everybody working from home, and you or I are sat here together, but the first time we've been using wired headsets for a while, means that everyone's sitting at home spending a hell of a lot of time on their browser. It's web calls, it's tools, it's collaboration, it's all of that, and everything is done in a web browser. But if you look at the data pieces coming through, they don't actually matter to the attacker until they get to the browser, because that's the goal. That's my destination. Looking at HTML smuggling, what it actually does is use download optimization. Rather than doing a serial download, what if I split my file up into 25 different pieces, download them all simultaneously, reconstructed at the other end. You put that through your network security, and what does it see? It sees 25 little blobs of data that do nothing. I don't know what it is. I don't even know what data type it is. I haven't got a clue. I guess I've got to let it through. So even if you have, and I'll make up a policy that says no executables can come through my gateway, an executable didn't come through your gateway. 25 little blobs of data did, and when it got to the browser, it can use JavaScript to combine all those things together, and you've got an executable on your endpoint.
How do you begin to look for that? How do you begin to spot it? How do you begin to defend against it? Because there are other things that people are using that legitimately use the same type of approach.
What you absolutely cannot do is block that technology, because the technology is the same. It's useful for legitimate reasons. But it's all about where you look. Where do you employ your security? If all your work is being done in the browser, but your defenses are outside of that, that's where that gap comes in. As we look at that visibility and the control, it really needs to be integrated into that browsing experience. And I use those words carefully, because I'm not necessarily saying this is a Chrome plugin or something there, but it needs to look at what the end user is seeing, what is actually being done in the browser. There's a lot of power in the browser these days about things it can do. So for threats that are coming in, where your policy is enforced, everything that you need to do, it needs to exist at the end state, not the transitory state that's in there. Looking at the tooling, everything that's been put in place, looking at your IPS, your firewall, your everything else, I guess maybe I've already half answered that question, but where is it that you're looking for the problem? What is it that you look to enforce? How do you do it? We need to move closer to the user, closer to not just the device, but the browser, the application on the device, because even your endpoint security tools don't necessarily understand, or at least not with 100% effectiveness, the inner workings of a browser and everything that's going on and everything that might be integrated into that. Whereas if your attacker can get something to the browser and obviously the end user still has to sit there and click it, then it can actually get through all the pieces that are in there. Not to say that you don't need endpoint. Absolutely you do. But to quote a term from the past, we need to go back or maybe invest a little more time in that defense in depth approach to say, I want multiple bites at trying to solve this problem. And as we've moved towards the D and the R, whichever letter you choose to put in the front, we're saying, well, I'm assuming you're going to get this far, and this is where I'm going to start putting my defenses. I think we need to move a bit further back out.
Let's talk here for a little while about the enterprise, not the small and medium-sized business, but the enterprise, because they have a very specific set of additional problems. The enterprise has been very happy with bring your own device. Financial directors are happily counting the fact that they're no longer giving large amounts of money to IT to go and buy new toys. Yep. The problem with that is we no longer own those devices. We can't dictate what goes on those devices. People have tried that. How do we therefore get closer to the end user, to what the end user's doing, without intruding on what at the end of the day is their device, their privacy, their right to say what is on that device?
This is a problem that going through the whole work from home exercise, let's call it, that we all went through in the last couple of years, it wasn't even a policy that companies would like to have. Some people were stuck at home with whatever it is you've got. You might not have had a laptop, you might have left it in the office and you can't go get it, you might just have your phone, an iPad, and whatever it might be. It's something that organizations needed to do out of necessity, and now we realize that we need to do it because end users' attitudes towards how I work, and what I do, and what device I choose, it's worked for the last 2 years, I don't see why you're complaining now, but I want to continue doing this. And so I absolutely agree in terms of unmanaged devices and security needing to apply there. There's a couple of key things there. First of all, I'll actually take a little path off to the side here. Looking at your unmanaged devices, personal device, as well as your corporate laptop that you might have, you can actually connect the two. If I put on my MacBook, enter in my Apple ID, do you know what I get on my corporate machine? All of my text messages, all of anything I want from my phone. So it isn't necessarily just an unmanaged device. They might actually be passing things that you were looking at anyway through to your corporate machine, which is another story in itself. Going back to the unmanaged piece, for accessing applications, corporate resources, and everything else, like you said, you cannot dictate what's on there. You cannot say you must download this client. You cannot say you must put on this mobile device management solution. As we look at how we do that, we have to look at security differently rather than replacing your secure remote access, let's say, with take out one client, put in another client. Do you know what we've got on every single unmanaged device? A browser. I mentioned it about how do you work? You work in the browser. Well, if you've got a browser, we can use that to authenticate you. We can use that as a method of pulling it together into zero trust network access, into security policy. Prove to me who you are. You can tie that in with Okta. You can do your multi-factor authentication, but you're using a tool, an application that everybody chooses to put on their endpoint, and it doesn't matter which browser it is, you can use that browserless version of authentication and zero trust to say what you have access to and what you don't, and how you control it.
But there is an issue with the browser. I use an awful lot of online apps, and I have multiple browsers on my Mac and multiple browsers on my PC. Why? Because some of these online apps won't play nicely with certain browsers, and we're talking about Edge, Safari, Brave, which is a Chromium browser. Actually, Edge is a Chromium browser as well.
They're all Chromium.
Different versions of the same thing. For an enterprise, its biggest problem with all these people working from home is going to be saying to people, this is now our corporate browser of choice because we can better manage that. The kickback is going to be huge. How do we therefore resolve that without going back to where we started when we started writing web apps, of writing 4, 5, 6 different versions to cope with 4, 5, 6 different browsers and variations thereof.
What I won't address is the application interoperability with browsers. That's up to the application developers. I will leave that one to them. But when it comes to securing that connection, again, I agree with you completely, and I'll give you the Menlo perspective on that. Your end users should be able to use the tool they choose, the device they choose, the application they choose, the location they choose, everything as they choose, and we can develop our capabilities and private access capabilities to say it doesn't matter. If you're using Safari, great. Just come into the portal, authenticate yourself, and Okta, you get the tiles of which applications, just click on it. Again, I'm not going to say if the application will work with a particular browser. That is not my deal. But securing that connection, controlling it, and even using things like our isolation core, which powers a lot of our platform, to be able to say if you're coming in on Safari, you know what? You're on a mobile device. You're using Safari. I don't know what network you're on. I'll just give you read-only. You can still access the application, but I'm going to control, based on everything I know about you, what you can do. If you connect into that on a different device, on a known network, read-write, go for it.
But that's great if you are a large enterprise. But SMEs, and I said I'd come back to them, they have a specific problem. Large enterprise can set policy. It can enforce policy to a degree. The SME is in a real difficult position. They don't necessarily have a security team. If they do, it's undermanned. They have been persuaded to go through MSSPs. And one of the dangers is too many of them think that once they hand it to the MSSP, it's no longer their problem. There's this belief that they can abdicate responsibility by giving it to somebody else. That's not right. It's not even legally possible to do such a thing. But they do it. How do we get MSSPs to set policies in such a way that they're not trying to uniquely define these policies for each of their clients, but actually they act as a single enterprise in how they then push this forward, because that has to be a better way for them to run their business, and in itself an easier way for them to start to spot these evasive and adaptive threats.
Agree completely. When we're looking at MSSPs, specifically for SMBs or SMEs, I think there's definitely a scale factor that they have to consider for their business. How much work are they willing to put in for the price that their customers are willing to pay them to do that? A lot of, I'll call it consolidation of standard policy is clear. If I can just click a button and you get basic security, great. And if you want more, then maybe we can charge more or just turn that on for you. The multi-tiered approach to platforms can enable them to do that if an MSSP chooses to do that. As my parent account, I have these 10 rules, these 10 policies that everybody gets no matter what. If you want more than that, great, but you don't get less. That's the rules that we go by. But it does come down to the MSSP and what they're willing to do. What we look at from a security perspective, and it makes it easier for MSSPs as well as SMBs if they choose to go their own path, with the Menlo solution, what we don't look to do, and again, going back to my choose your letter DR, what you get with that is a ton of alerts. What happened? Where did it happen? All of the information. And what do I do with that?
The problem with alerts for me is that people are drowning in alerts. They don't want alerts. They just simply want to know X has happened. Here's your playbook. And despite the effort by several vendors in the market to move down that line, that's not the standard response at the moment. People are still just getting alert fatigue.
Absolutely, and we recognize that. Coming back to something I mentioned earlier around how we try to utilize our isolation core as the prevention piece of threats coming in, ultimately, what are we doing? Rather than having websites connect to a browser on the endpoint, on the device, that website or that SaaS app, private app, whatever it might be, is actually connecting to a browser in our cloud security platform, and then we're connecting from that browser down. So as you look at the active content that could be malicious, everything gets treated exactly the same. But any attack that's trying to use active content to get to the browser, do you know what browser they've got? It's not Safari, it's not Edge, it's none of that. It's our weird modified browser up in the cloud that they have no idea what it is, what it does, how it's changed, what it's different. They believe they're on an end user device, so they're looking for things that just don't exist. And all we deliver is that safe content. For all the threats that we will stop, we don't alert the administrator and say, hey, there's a thing. hey, there's a thing, hey, there's a thing, we actually just stop it. We'll tell them what happened, but I don't need to alert you about it. What a lot of our customers see, as well as from a security effectiveness perspective, is good, but they see a whole lot less alerts coming in as well. One of our customers down in Australia put in our solution back to 2018. They've seen a 95% decrease in endpoint alerts going forward because there was nothing for the endpoint to alert on. It just got stopped somewhere else. Coming back to that defense in depth, if I can stop it before it comes in, I absolutely should. If I can stop it in the network, I absolutely should. The endpoint should be the last resort, not the eggs in one basket of everything being there. The differentiated approach, whether it's an MSSP looking for that information, whether it's an SMB that doesn't have a security team, wouldn't even understand the alert. You can get that information, but not in a way that is overwhelming and telling you 20 things that you don't need to worry about and one thing that you do.
Let's go back to that evasive and adaptive piece. We all think we know what the bad guys are after. We know that in most cases, they've created an as-a-service business where they've built a library of tools and they're quite happily pulling in script kiddies to assemble those tools and launch those attacks for them. And for that, they will pay them a fee. But if these things are going to be good at being evasive and good at being adaptive, does that market still hold true? Or are you expecting to see more threat actors want to own those tools themselves rather than run a service?
I would cut this a couple of different ways. It will depend on the type of attack and it will depend on the target of that attack. We've seen a lot of the larger attack groups going after higher profile victims, say using a tool like HTML smuggling. If I'm going to use an approach that maybe I cannot farm this out because not everybody does this, I'm going to save that. The more difficult to detect, more customized attacks for the victims that I'm really trying to get a big payday. I'm saving the good stuff for the big customers. For everyone else, when it comes to, say, getting past URL reputation, am I going to go out there and search for log4j vulnerabilities? Maybe, but I'm sure I can pay somebody to do that, so that element can get taken care of. What we've also seen prior to log4j is a lot of the attack groups out there building legitimate websites and then just leaving them. This is a big, big shift from the days where I would build a site, domain, content, malware, go, because URL reputation fixed that, right? I looked at it, super new, never seen it before, out. Whereas now if I build it, I build up all this content around financial services, and I leave it there for 6 months or a year, I can build another one, build another one, build another one. Actually building their supply chain of entirely legitimate, benign sites that they then use as their supply chain of malicious sites as when they want to flip them. Are they going to do that themselves? Probably not. I'm not going to sit there building a website if I'm the hacker king here that's trying to do something really bad. I can farm all of that out and then I just burn them whenever I need them.
Interesting you say that piece about reputation. I probably get 7 or 8 emails a week of people offering me their SEO services and they can take articles from our website and place them on these other sites with a reputation of 40 plus or 50 plus or 60 plus. I have no intention of using their services, but it intrigues me how many are out there and what they're offering. And it makes you wonder how many people are unwittingly falling for the reputation game.
Yeah, absolutely. We hear about SEO poisoning. If I take my legitimate site, I promote everything in it, might even pay to get it up there if you really want to, you've really got something good. And what do you do when you get to the top of Google? You trust it. That's exactly it. If it's there, I'm sure it's fine. The URL looks okay. Some of the heat characteristics that we've seen out there is using SEO poisoning to actually improve the volume or the field that I can actually get this threat out to, but it doesn't have to come from a malicious site.
So what should I be looking for to know that I'm facing a heat attack?
As an end user, you won't see anything because it's how I get past the technology that's between me and you. As an administrator looking at threats coming in, connections coming in, they might be threats. To know what's happening, you have to try and look forward, but definitely look back. What I mean is using the example of a benign website, a legitimate website being used to push malware. What did it say when somebody clicked on it? What was the category at that time? It said it was financial services. But if I look further in time, that actually then switched to malicious or uncategorized or whatever it might have switched to. It's that analysis of if I don't look, I don't know. You'll never see. You need to check and validate the before and after. If you're looking for HTML smuggling, for example, unless you really dive in and figure out the website and the mechanism and the everything else, you're not going to see it. That's why we need to move away from the D and the R to preventative, to say, you know what, I don't care if you're using download optimization. Awesome, great. But you're going to download that file into my browser in my isolation core. I'm going to check the file before I download it to the end user. I'm going to make sure that that whole executable, if you've got a policy that says no executable, it's not going anywhere. But you have to have that level of control in between before anything gets to the end user.
How do you do that at scale? It's nice to say, oh, I'm going to intercept that, I'm going to look at it, make a decision, and hand it off to you. End users don't have that patience. They're not willing to wait. They've clicked on that button to download that file. They expect that file now. Any suggestion that you are delaying delivery is going to create a lot of conversations within the organization, and none of them good. So how do you achieve this without, once again, IT and security being seen as a bottleneck?
As I've done for most of your questions, I'll answer that two ways. There's the file example that you spoke about. So on the question of how do you do this at scale, you use clouds and infrastructure that can scale with you. Our service is based at its core on AWS. If we need more scale, if we take on 2 million more end users tomorrow, that's okay. We can just scale our AWS infrastructure to go with it. From a performance perspective, it's really not an issue. When it comes to analyzing a file, it might take a couple of seconds, but it's certainly not going to materially delay anything that's coming through from the web through to an end user. If we see it, policy blocked it, I'll immediately tell you I blocked it. If it's checked for maliciousness, then it might take a few seconds, but it's not anything that would cause concern, let's say. Actually, the bigger problem with doing everything that we spoke around about stopping these threats coming in, about giving a safe internet experience, as we said, to an end user, is how do you make the internet act the way that it was meant to act, or a website? Because websites, browsers are so powerful now that I cannot just push something through a cloud platform and say, you know what, I checked it, it's good, it's bad. Because you search for in Google is restaurants near me. And if I tell you about a restaurant that's in a different country, that is not going to help you. This is not how the internet is meant to work. If you try and use capture, and capture keeps on saying, no, you're a robot, that's not how it's meant to work. If I make everything really slow, that's not how it's meant to work. So the more complicated problem to solve is really all the behavior of websites with different plugins and tools and scripts and capabilities that you need to reflect from the cloud platform down to the endpoint, and actually you don't even know that we are there. I have this panacea of security that's entirely invisible to the end user. If I look at things that get in the way of me doing work, if it doesn't work, I'm just going to go around it. I'll get off this internet, I'll go on my hotspot, and I'll do something different. It's human nature. But if you deliver that experience in a way that is everything you expected it to be, the right speed, the right performance, the right features, the right everything, I have nothing to try and go around. I just get on with my work. The end user is happy because everything works as it should do. And the security team is happy because they now, once again, have complete visibility of everything that's going on, and they can see if any threats are coming in, if someone's going to places they shouldn't, and they have no gaps in their security visibility anymore.
Normally at this point, I say, imagine you're in a room full of people, which we finally can after the last 2 years, and they're all going, heat, what am I supposed to do with this? Give them three things they can take away and get started with.
I would view the security tools that you have in place today, because I think there's a lot that, as we look at cataloging what it is we do as a security organization, even within a company, what is it that we have? What does it do? How does it integrate together to actually look at the starting point? Let's figure out where we start. We have several tools that are available in terms of customers being able to check their susceptibility to heat attacks, to say, is this a problem for you? Because for some people it will be, other people it might not. What we've seen is that many of the customers that have tried this already, it's a term that is new to a lot of people, but tied to attacks and threats that are not necessarily new, like ransomware and Trojans and everything else. Some people believe, I have a solution. I'll use ransomware as an example. I have a solution for ransomware. And as you said, there's a million different vendors that will solve, air quote, solve ransomware in a million different ways. but is it really working? Is it effective? Is it not? Is it a backup and recovery that didn't stop the threats? You get the picture. You can figure out what you've got. You can verify if you're susceptible to it. But I think the most important thing is, as you look at your security spend, don't spend more money on exactly the same tools and expect a different outcome. And again, I'll use ransomware as an example. Ransomware is something that you're very concerned about, and you think you might be susceptible to some form of it. Don't just buy more of the same thing and think, nah, I'm good now. We need to do something differently as an industry, as the security community, to put another barrier in front of the attackers coming in. I will tell you from the Menlo perspective that the easiest barrier to add in there is using an isolation core and those types of capabilities to prevent those threats from getting in the first place. Before they even get in through the door, before they get to my network, before they get to my data, my applications, I stop them right at the front. But whether it's Menlo, whether it's some other solution out there, we haven't put any new barriers for the attackers for the last 10 years, which is why we're seeing the results that we're seeing right now. Again, whether it's Menlo, whether it's some other vendor, figure out what that next barrier is. We've got to make it harder for them to get in the first place. I think we need to course correct on the over pivot that everybody made to detection and response and go, well, maybe I should try and prevent a whole lot more before I get to my detect and response and not just, I don't want to say admit defeat, but I'm going to assume they're going to be in there anyway, no matter what I do. I think that's quite a sad state of affairs. If we go, well, they're already in there, let's just try and make the best of it. No, let's at least do the best we can to stop them from getting in. So whether it's isolation, whether it's browser-level policies that you put in place to try and prevent some of the things coming in, put something in place so that you're making it harder for the attackers to get into you. Then, from a very personal perspective, they'll go elsewhere. They'll at least leave me alone. But if, as an organization, as a community, as a world, we actually say, you know what, let's all put different barriers in front of the attackers, make them work harder for everything that they're going to get, then fewer people will get attacked successfully. There will be a lot less money in it, so therefore there'll be fewer gangs and groups that go after this, and it starts to redress where we are right now, where it's amazingly fruitful and reasonably easy to set something up and get going and get good money out of it. So let's just make them work for that money.
I often liken it to home security. There's a whole bunch of steps you can take that are inexpensive that will stop 90% of people getting into your house. The remaining 10% are going to get in no matter what. But in cybersecurity, we're not even preventing that 10% getting in. We've got to shift that. And in 40 years around this industry, 30 of it talking cybersecurity, I think we're almost as far away now as we were at the beginning. Looking through my inbox, I have this report sitting there that you've just issued. Do you want to give us a heads up on some of the key pieces from that?
There's a whole lot of statistics in there. One I mentioned around heat attacks growing 224%, almost 70% of attacks overall are using these heat characteristics. What's more interesting to me is some of the insights that we can pull out from the data. And I don't want to spoil it all, so I'm not going to go through all the insights, but I'll give you a snippet to get people going. So the first thing that's in there, which I think is really no surprise to many, is that companies, boards care about ransomware. It is a problem that will have significant impact if it's successful with me. It is something that I'm looking to solve. But they have many different ways. As we've mentioned, there's a million companies saying I solve ransomware in a million different ways. At Menlo, we believe it should be at the very front of that kill chain before anything comes in and not once it gets in and trying to detect and respond. So they care about ransomware. The COVID situation of people working from home has had a very big impact of how do I do this? Because anything you had in place protecting your corporate network, you're protecting a network that nobody uses anymore. Now everybody is at home and the internet is the network. So how do we protect it? Well, and I've mentioned this a few times, we have to do things in a fundamentally different way, even from that perspective, to get back to the status quo of where we were. I want no security gaps. I want no security black spots where I don't know what's going on. But I need to cope with unmanaged devices. I need to cope with multiple different networks that I don't know what they are, where they are. Do I trust them? I don't know. But we've got to take all of that into account to say what's coming through. So they care about ransomware. It's got a whole lot more difficult. But as they look at how they solve the problem, so I mentioned the million vendors, million different ways, but you could also solve it through training. You could also solve it through process. It's not just a technology problem for ransomware, you can do many different ways. Boiling down what it is that will be most effective, what will be the biggest bang for the buck in terms of if I spend a dollar, where do I put it? There's an ocean of things that I could do. Where should I place my bet? And then what does that mean for my company? So it's not necessarily a simple thing of I would like to stop ransomware, let me push the button, done. There's very much a thought process that needs to go into it. Again, from the Menlo perspective, some of the things that they can and they should do is look at those. Do you want to train people not to click on the link? Absolutely, you should. Is that going to work effectively 100% of the time? It absolutely is not. There is always going to be someone who is always going to click on the link, no matter what you say or do. But again, it comes down to how do I solve ransomware? Is it with endpoint? Will it solve it? It absolutely will. Is your endpoint protection on every single device? No, because we have unmanaged devices, so I have an exposure. I have some old endpoints that, or servers, things that they couldn't even run this thing if they tried. So there's gaps that are in there. Coming back to my defense in depth point, do we need to do it? Yes, we absolutely do, but we need to make sure that we layer your endpoint with your network piece, with your preventative front door, as it were, for your analogy of protecting your house. If you can't get through the front door, then you win. If you can, then we need to make sure that we've got other things inside. And as a note, so I am from the UK, but I live in the US. And when my father, my parents came out many years ago, I told them that the house was made of wood. All the houses, I live in California, are wood framed because we have earthquakes in California and wood falling will not kill you, bricks falling will. So everything is made of wood. And my dad said, well, that means someone could walk up to the side of your door with a rotary saw and just saw through the wall. Honestly, they could if they chose to, but again, it comes back down to the defense in depth. I've got a really good front door, it locks. I've got a screen door on the front that locks, but if you drill through the wall, then I've got my cameras and my motion sensors and my alarm, and it will go straight to the police and everything else. So coming back to that defense in depth posture, I think is absolutely everything that we need to do.
Mark, thank you for your time this afternoon.
No problem. Thank you.